Today is Wednesday, April 25th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, as the president welcomes his French counterpart, he's not saying what he'll do about the Iran nuclear deal.
It's a bad deal. It's a bad structure. It's falling down. Should have never, ever been made.
Toronto police believe the man who plowed his van into a crowd of people Monday did so intentionally. Also ahead, news about one of the hottest musicians on the planet right now. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, alongside visiting French President Emmanuel Macron, President Donald Trump Tuesday said Kim Jong-un wants a historic high-stakes meeting as soon as possible and suggested the North Korean dictator had a sharply different assessment of a leader he once denounced as Little Rocket Man.
Kim Jong-un really has been very open and I think very honorable from everything we're seeing.
But he again suggested that he would leave the table if the negotiations were not productive or if North Korea was not operating in good faith. The United States and North Korea have been negotiating a summit between Trump and Kim to be held in May or June to broker a deal on Pyongyang's nuclear program. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with senior defense analyst Bruce Bennett with the RAND Corporation, who's currently in Seoul, South Korea, about the president's comments ahead of Friday's historic meeting between North Korea's Kim Jong-un and South Korean leader Moon Jae-in.
What Kim is trying to do right now is to convince everybody that he's a great guy. I mean, the change in public opinion, according to the pollsters here in Seoul, has been dramatic. The polls now are showing that many people in South Korea don't think he's all that bad a guy. And so there's been this shift in opinion. I think Trump is hopeful that the maximum pressure campaign has convinced Kim that he has to give up the nuclear weapons. But he's also hedging because the Kim family has been duplicitous in the past. They've never really quite done what they said they were going to do. In fact, usually they've not done it at all. So he's hopeful. He'd like to resolve the situation peacefully. He's seeing that Kim is saying that's possible, but he's also being careful that he can't count on it.
What is the atmosphere there, if you can, on this pending inter-Korean summit Friday?
Oh, people are very excited. They have the sense that things are going to work out, that there's going to be a positive outcome. Not that Kim will give up all his nuclear weapons immediately, but that at least the environment and atmosphere of a peaceful situation will be established. That seems to be President Moon's key objective, and that from that, then the details can be worked out over time. My understanding is President Moon thinks that his progressive predecessor, President Noh Moo-hyun, waited too long in his presidency to start negotiating with the North. So President Moon wants a significant development in his first year, which ends on May 10th. So he wants to reset the environment, the atmosphere for discussions, and then move forward and work out the details.
There's a lot of deep skepticism among many experts about Kim Jong-un's intentions. Are you among the skeptics?
Sure, I'm among the skeptics. Now, am I saying that it's impossible? No. But I'll believe him when he starts acting. I keep arguing, look, Kim has got to give up some nuclear weapons now. I think if next Monday after the summit he turned five nuclear weapons over to the French, one of the five authorized nuclear powers by the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that would be a good symbol. Kim seems to think that the promises he's making are really dramatic and important. And I think most Americans in particular are saying, talk is cheap. Let's see you do something that really illustrates intent.
He did move Saturday to pledge no more nuclear or missile testing and to decommission, if you will, a nuclear testing site. But that's just mere word, not actual action.
And in a addition, the Americans have been looking for the concept of complete, verifiable, and irreversible dismantlement of the program. Saying that you're going to stop tests is not irreversible. So he's done something, but it's not, and it doesn't really meet the requirements that the U.S. has on denuclearization. And he's got to do something more than just make promises that he could well be planning on breaking.
Is Mr. Trump over the top when he refers to Kim Jong-un as, quote, very honorable?
Well, I think what he's saying is that he's been honorable in the discussions about the summit so far. Where things go from here has to be really determined. What's he going to be insisting that President Moon do on Friday this week when South and North have their summit? What's Kim going to be prepared to do next week or the week after to really demonstrate a willingness to give up his nuclear program? He's going to get far more points, Kim will, by giving things up before the summit with President Trump and demonstrating real sincerity than he is if he waits until afterwards.
All right, that's Bruce Bennett with the RAND Corporation. Well, North Korea wasn't the only country the French and American leaders discussed at the White House. They called for expanded negotiations with Iran as next month's deadline approaches for the U.S. to decide whether to renew sanctions waivers on Tehran. But there was no indication whether President Trump would pull the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal, something he has threatened.
France and the United States also agree that Iran cannot be allowed to develop a nuclear weapon, and that regime must end its support of terrorism.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani warned Tuesday of severe consequences if the U.S. withdraws from the agreement. Hassan Banai, Indiana University Assistant Professor of International Studies, though, is skeptical of that.
I think Iran ultimately has far more to lose by pulling out of the deal than any other party to the agreement. Iran knows that it would expose itself to possible military attack. Iran knows that this will definitely have a devastating economic impact. Iran also knows that Europeans can very easily splinter and kind of rejoin the American camp if Iran undertakes any kind of military activities or restarts its program back to the level that it was before the negotiations for JCPOA took place. So Iran has to walk a very fine line because ultimately it is a party that could set itself up if it resumes its nuclear program by giving the United States all the excuses that it needs.
Well, many analysts believe U.S. withdrawal of the deal could create major discord between key transatlantic partners and throw the Middle East into even deeper turmoil. But with all the serious issues being discussed by the president and the French leader, Trump also welcomed Emmanuel Macron and his wife to a state dinner, the first of his presidency. Macron and his wife Brigitte arrived at the White House as a light rain fell Tuesday evening. Trump and Melania exchanged hugs and air kisses with the Macrons before going inside the White House for the festivities. About 130 guests have been invited.
The wonderful friendship we have developed over the last year is a testament to the enduring friendship that binds our two nations.
And apparently the state dinner and the First Lady's dress are all the talk on social media. For that part of the story, we hear from VOA's Doug Bernard.
This is the first state dinner that President Trump and his wife Melania are hosting at the White House. So, and Melania has reportedly planned the whole thing out herself. So it's getting a lot of attention. People are, believe it or not, wanting to talk about this. And, of course, they're injecting politics into it. Here's Steve Schmidt, the former campaign advisor to Republican Senator John McCain. He tweets, "The relationship between the U.S. and France, our first and oldest ally, will be celebrated tonight at a state dinner. That not a single leader of the Democratic Party is invited is another Trump assault on the dignity of his office and our country. Lafayette must be weeping." Howard Fineman, the political commentator and journalist, shares similar thoughts. Trump's unprecedented refusal to invite a single member of the opposition party is, as he writes, vivid evidence of the cancerous tribalism eating away at American ideals of democracy. Pretty hard words there. Not everybody, obviously, is in agreement. Here's Mike Mike Zolo. Forget presidents. No person has ever been so badly treated by the media and the left than Donald Trump. They can cry all they want about him not inviting them to the state dinner. They're anti-American. Not only shouldn't they be invited, they should be deported. So some strong thoughts there. Now, believe it or not, not only is who is and is not on the guest list at the state dinner, but another topic, sort of a smaller topic of some controversy, is the menu, the evening menu that was planned out by Melania Trump. We'll get to that in a quick second. Here's Eric Erickson, who's echoing a lot of thoughts of some conservatives. He's a conservative commentator. This is why I could never be president. And then he links to the menu. He says, I'd serve fried chicken and mashed potatoes with sweet potato pie for dessert. None of this unpronounceable frou-frou garbage. Well, let's take a look at what the unpronounceable frou-frou garbage is. First course is a goat cheese gâteau, tomato jam, buttermilk biscuit crumbles, and young variegated lettuces. The main course is rack of spring lamb, burnt cipollini soubise, and Carolina gold rice jambalaya. And the dessert is a nectarine tart, yum, and creme fraiche ice cream. I'm not sure what exactly. Interestingly, by the way, a lot of these menu items are from the American South, and the American South, in turn, was greatly influenced by French cooking. So that's really why a number of these dishes were chosen. Jambalaya, for example, comes from the French word jambon or jambon, which just means ham. But I guess for some people, it's just unpronounceable frou-frou garbage.
All right, VOA's Doug Bernard. You can follow him on Twitter at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following at VOAnews.com. International child abductions have drawn an outcry on Capitol Hill. A Toronto driver left a cryptic Facebook message before an attack. Bin Laden's security guard is living in Germany as a refugee. And the U.S. Supreme Court will hear the travel ban case on Wednesday. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Toronto police say the driver who allegedly ran down and killed 10 pedestrians on a downtown sidewalk with his van did leave a cryptic Facebook message just moments before the attack. A court Tuesday charged Alec Minassian with 10 counts of first-degree murder and 13 counts of attempted murder. He kept his head down and did not enter a plea. Toronto Police Chief Mark Saunders.
Based on witness accounts, we have a vehicle that started north on Yonge Street from Finch and drove southbound at some point in times on sidewalks, at some point in times driving southbound in the northbound lane. So it's very clear just from a general perspective to say that the actions definitely look deliberate.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau Tuesday offered support to his grieving nation.
The events that took place yesterday in Toronto were a senseless attack and a horrific tragedy. On behalf of all Canadians, I offer my deepest heartfelt condolences to the loved ones of all those who were killed, and we wish a full recovery to those injured and stand with the families and friends of the victims.
Witnesses, police are examining what they describe as Minassian's cryptic message, hoping it'll help them figure out his motive. While it's still unclear, Trudeau did dismiss the possibility of terrorism.
At this time, we have no reason to suspect that there is any national security element to this attack.
Witnesses say Minassian drove as fast as 80 kilometers per hour for more than a kilometer down the busy sidewalk in northern Toronto. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. This week, we discuss the various tactics that the Kremlin uses to wage political warfare in Western democracies and how to combat it with Alina Polyakova, Senior Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, in remote parts of the world where medical care is practically non-existent, tribal communities face many physical challenges such as snake bites, tuberculosis, pregnancy complications, and of course, malaria. Such is the case for remote villagers living in Stone Age conditions along the Sepik River in Papua New Guinea. Healthcare facilities are extremely limited and can take up to 7 days paddling in a canoe to reach the hospital. Joining us now is Mark Palm, the founder of Samaritan Aviation. Mark and his team have been responding to emergency calls from villagers. Over the last 7 years, they've vaccinated over 2,000 children and for 12 life-threatening diseases and delivered close to 140,000 pounds of medical supplies. Thank you for being with us, Mark. First, just tell us a little bit about your organization.
We're a Christian charity who does relief work in Papua New Guinea using seaplanes, and we work in an area where there's 600,000 people, one hospital, and there's a large river there that's 400 miles long, kind of the size of the Mississippi would be a good description for those in America, and 80% of these people, there's 220,000 people that live alongside this river, and those people are 3 to 5 days away from the one hospital. And so we are a lifeline and access and hope for those people. And we use seaplanes. We can land anywhere along this river, and we pick up emergency flights are on call 7 days a week for emergency flight calls for breech births, snake bites, crocodile bites, any type of sickness. Malaria is a huge problem, tuberculosis. And so we get calls from 40 different aid posts that we work with along this river. And we go in, get these people out of the remote village, get them to the help that they need. We also deliver medical supplies. We delivered 138,000 pounds of medicine in the last 8 years to these remote aid posts. And then we work in disaster relief. So if there's a sickness outbreak like measles, whooping cough, cholera, those type of things, we are able to quickly respond with medical professionals and medicine to help stop those outbreaks.
I understand some of these really remote villages, many of them people living in very primitive conditions without any, I would imagine, running water or any kind of health facilities.
Yeah, the areas that we work are very remote along the river. There's really no electricity. There's no running water. There's really no roads to these areas as well. There's only two roads on this 400-mile-long river, and that's why having a seaplane and being able to go in, you're talking 3 to 5 days to get to the hospital or a 45-minute flight in a seaplane. And so we're working with people that really have no other way to get to the hospital when they have an emergency situation. And so we're able to get in there quickly and save their life. And, you know, it's amazing. I try to wrap my head around what it would be like up in a seaplane on the side of the bank of a remote river and a village, and flown into WEWAC where you're seeing the ocean for the first time, cars, electricity. And that's a big part of what we do as well, as we come alongside those patients as we bring them in to give, make sure they have food, clothing, and those sorts of things after we get them to the town and to the hospital as well.
So really, these people have never literally seen some of the things that we take for granted in civilization, like cars and electricity?
Yeah, they don't exist. You know, when there's no roads for a couple hundred miles along the side of a river, and it's very expensive and takes several days to get out to a civilization where in a town that we live in, lots of the people have never seen those things. And so, yeah, it's a definite shock for them.
And are they receptive? Are the people, given that they've never been exposed to any sort of actual structured health care, are they open to it and receptive? I guess they must be.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are those remote aid posts and that have basically a community health worker that's there, so not the level, to a level of a nurse, but just below that, so they can give them some basic care. And, you know, when you're in a desperate situation, we focus on life and death situations. And so if you've been bitten by a poisonous snake and you've got a couple hours to live, no one's arguing, you know, when a plane sweeps in and brings medicine and a nurse and rushes them back to the hospital. And they've been very receptive to receiving help. They understand through just the communication up and down the river that hospital is where they need to go to get the help they need.
Any plans to expand to any other regions as far as what you're doing? Because it sounds like it's a really worthwhile mission that I'm sure there are other places that could really use use your help.
Yeah, you know, New Guinea, it's amazing. The island is the second largest island in the world, and so it's a very big island, and there are several other areas on the island that we're looking at going to. We're actually looking to expand to the western province on the Gulf side of Papua New Guinea in the next 3 years. So we have 2 aircraft currently and 4 staff families in Papua New Guinea right now. And so we are looking to branch out and expand and duplicate on the Fly River, which is on the other side of the island and is even more remote and even more water as we look for expansion in the next 3 years over there as well.
Must be very rewarding. I see you vaccinated over 2,500 children with some life-threatening illnesses or diseases.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing. It's something that I felt called to do as a 16-year-old. Saw the need. I was over there with a friend in 1994. The 19-year-old saw the need for this work and this mission and came back, and took us several years, a lot of training, but we were able to get back there in 2010 with a seaplane, and it's been amazing as we've saved hundreds of lives every year. And it's very rewarding to go back in and see these families, see the lives that have been saved through the work that we do, and be able to have those relationships. Hard to put into words.
All right, Mark Palm, founder of Samaritan Aviation, thanks for sharing your story of the life-saving work you're doing. Well, a rap singer who is one of the hottest musicians on the planet right now has a hot new single and 8 Billboard Music Award nominations. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to talk more about it.
Cardi B. Her real name, by the way, is Belcalis Almanzar. And how she came about Cardi B? Well, she said it's a nickname because her sister's name is Hennessy. So she was named after Bacardi, the famous rum. So they call her Cardi. She said she added the B, which stands for beautiful. And she is indeed. And Cardi B's new album, breaking all kinds of records. The album is called Invasion of Privacy. It went to #1 where it debuted. It streamed over 100 million times in its first week, which is just an unbelievable record, which had previously been held by Beyonce. And now Cardi B owns that record. Cardi was nominated for several BET Awards last year on the success of her hit Bodak Yellow, which went up to #1 and made her the second ever female rapper to reach #1 on the Billboard charts. The first was Lauryn Hill in 1998. And Cardi B's new album has already given us a couple of hits. She's got a new song out, which we're going to check out right now. I want to hear I Like It. Here's Cardi B with J Balvin. I like it,
I like stunning, I like shining, I like $1 million deals, where's my pen, I'm signing, I like those Balenciagas, the ones that look like socks, I like going to the Tula, I put rocks all in my watch, I like sexes from my exes when they want a second chance.
Well, certainly, Larry, rap seems to be increasingly in the mainstream of music.
Everything rap, hip-hop, R&B, soul, definitely it's getting its turn in the spotlight these days. Black Panther, you know, became huge in the box office, still remains huge in the box office, breaking all kinds of records. Cardi B's riding the wave of success, much like Nicki Minaj and artists very similar to her genre, her style of music, although she's got her own unique flair. It's kind of unfiltered. She says what she thinks, and she doesn't hold back. She's engaged to Offset, who is a member of a group called Migos. She's pregnant with her first child, with Offset. There was a big scandal in the broadcast industry last year when Offset was caught cheating. Not once, but twice, fathered a child with another woman. And Cardi B's constantly asked, what are your thoughts? What's the relationship? What's going on? And she said, leave us alone. Leave me alone. It's a private matter. I'm dealing with it. He and I are still together, still getting married. And, of course, the baby's coming sometime in the summer. And Cardi B's just been all over the place. She was at Coachella Valley Music Festival for the second weekend in a row. She sang the song that we just heard with J Balvin called I Like It on stage with J Balvin. You know, she got paid only $70,000 for performing at Coachella and spent $300,000 on her stage. So she put her own money out there. She had a song out a few weeks ago, which she released from her Invasion of Privacy album called Be Careful. Some believe that's a message to Offset, her fiancé, that he better be careful. But Cardi B, you know, she's worked her way up through the ranks. She worked in an Amish supermarket when she was a teenager, and right around 19, she became a stripper, which she's gotten a lot of slack for, but she stands by that and says, I admire what they do. And she said, stripping helped pay for my breast implants. That's her
well, that's one way of looking looking at
That's her own quote. She was in GQ magazine this current month, this edition. She revealed a lot about herself and things that she likes and doesn't like. And one of the people that she admires, which is a surprise to everybody, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR. She said the guy was in a wheelchair, paralyzed, had polio, and he led this country. She said anybody like that deserves my respect. So that's how Cardi B is, and she's tremendously talented. Who knows where the future is going to take her? This is her debut album, Invasion of Privacy, and she's the hottest property right now, going out on tour this summer with Bruno Mars.
That kind of surprises me because she's so busy being pregnant with a wedding.
People are asking that very same question, is how will this impact the tour? And she says, I'm going to perform up until the minute I can't. She revealed her pregnancy on Saturday Night Live a couple of weekends ago. People had thought she was pregnant because she was wearing loose clothing, but then, you know, they put a spotlight on her with a tight dress. They pulled back, you know, the camera pulled back, and there it was, the baby bump, and it's out in the open now. Everybody knows it. And she's well along. It's got to be at least second trimester at this point, so the baby's coming sometime this summer. Cardi B, she's hot. She's out there, and you can't avoid her anyway. Even if you want, she's everywhere. Cardi B's new song is called I Like It with J Balvin.
All right. Thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
I said I like it like that. I'm a district in the chain.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On April 25th, we observe World Malaria Day. It is an occasion to recognize the global effort to effectively control and eventually eliminate this devastating disease. This year's theme is Ready to Beat Malaria. In 2016, 216 million people became sick with malaria, and over 445,000 died. The World Health Organization, or WHO, reports that 90% of malaria cases were reported in Africa, as were 91% of malaria-related deaths. The good news is malaria is preventable and curable. Over the last nearly two decades, there has been a coordinated global effort to eliminate the disease altogether. Between 2000 and 2015, new cases among populations at risk fell by 29% globally. After an unprecedented period of success in controlling this disease, it is clear that there is more work ahead. We continue to focus on prevention. Among the most successful weapons we have against this deadly disease are insecticide-treated nets and indoor spraying with insecticides to kill the mosquitoes that carry the illness, causing parasite. These preventative tools, when coupled with strategies to prevent malaria during pregnancy, low-cost diagnostic tools, and highly effective malaria treatments, dramatically reduce death and disease from malaria. Yet much more needs to be done. To address remaining challenges, including the emergence of drug-resistant malaria, the WHO has developed the Global Technical Strategy for Malaria, which provides a technical framework for all endemic countries as they work towards control and eventually elimination. The first goals to be reached by the year 2030 are to reduce malaria incidence by at least 90%, reduce malaria mortality rates by at least 90%, eliminate the disease in at least 35 countries, and prevent a resurgence of malaria in all countries that are malaria-free. If we are to be successful, donors must help fund the effort. The United States government has been involved in global malaria activity since the 1950s, and today is the largest donor to global malaria efforts, including through its President's Malaria Initiative and U.S. contributions to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. Still, if the 2030 targets of the Global Technical Strategy are to be achieved, total funding must increase substantially. On this day, we call on our friends and partners around the globe to reaffirm their commitment to this important effort and contribute the funds and support needed to help roll back and eventually eliminate malaria once and for all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.